Great to be back here.
I am so happy
that I am home.
I want to give a few words by way of explanation of a couple of things this morning. Number one, some of you may have noticed that there is no bulletin this morning. And it has been remarked upon that there was no bulletin in my absence. That is technically incorrect. There was a bulletin for the first Sunday, which I was gone. Because I printed one out ahead of time. And I had offered to the elders, do you want me to print out bulletins for all the weeks that I am gone? And I was told, no, don't worry about that. So that's not my fault. Now, about this morning, I just got into the country Friday night. So the very first opportunity I had to come to the building, time and jet lag and being dead to the world, what it is, was last night. And when I got here last night, I was ready, and I had just done the men's assignment schedule for December. And I was like, okay, let's print out the bulletin. No yellow ink. And it won't let you print anything if even one of the ink canisters is gone, is empty. So I apologize. Not my fault. Mechanical failure. But if you want to go online to check, not now, later, then you can see that the men's schedule is, in fact, done for December, for the upcoming month. I also don't have a presentation this morning. Time. There's only a limited number of minutes in the day. But open your Bibles, if you would, to the book of Psalms, chapter 90. We're going to be talking about that this morning. But as has become my habit and custom, let me provide you with a brief summary of the things that happened while I was in the Philippines. My trip went actually really well, for the most part, up until the day I was supposed to leave. There were a little few uh-oh moments, mostly to deal with the amount of mass we had in our luggage. You can't buy those luggage scales that, you know, you can use to pick up your luggage, and it'll tell you how much you weigh when you pick it up. You can't buy those in the Philippines. And some of the stuff we were shipping was actual boxes anyway, not suitcases, but actual boxes, real boxes. For all our Filipinos in the audience, the Balikbayan boxes. That's what we used. Best way to ship stuff. Because you can fit a lot in that, and it's just barely within the airline tolerances for size. So it's kind of hard to weigh those. And so what we had to do was weigh things piece by piece, bit by bit, and add it up as we went along. But sometimes you forget to amount for the mass of tape, and you have to tape these boxes up a lot to get them safely through the airplane. But then you also forget to amount for the mass of things like a bubble wrap. And so when you get to the airport, occasionally, oops, I have a few kilograms over. Now I have to open my box up and take stuff out. But we were very diligent about weighing stuff that we put in as we went through, and then we had to get my parents, my in-laws, because they had been living with Didith, and that's fine, that's the way it worked, and that's normal in the Philippines. Everybody knows who's Filipino knows that. And we had to get them into a new place, and so that was taking time, and so my time there was pretty packed. So we go to the airport Tuesday, the 25th, the day I'm supposed to leave to come back here. And we get to the airport, and we're sitting in the airport. And when our plane is supposed to depart, we're given the announcement that the plane, the way it works is that there's only one plane from that airline that goes to the town we were in and back from Manila. It leaves Manila, goes to Tuguegarao, then flies back to Manila. And it only does that once a day for PAL Express. That's the airline we were flying on. Never going to fly them again. Not locally. So, there we were, waiting for our PAL Express flight. And then, 30 minutes later, well, what they tell us when we're supposed to be boarding, or taking off, not just boarding, we're supposed to be taking off, they tell us the plane is now boarding in Manila. Then 30 minutes later, they tell us the flight has definitely been canceled. And then that's the second day in a row it was canceled. And they don't have a flight on Wednesday. We could only fly on Thursday. We wanted to get back because we were supposed to be at a big Thanksgiving dinner for our family. That's my grandma's first time to see her first and only great-grandchild. It's supposed to be really special. So we're like, okay, we're just going to take a bus from Tuguegarao to get back to Manila on Tuesday night to try and make a flight from Manila to San Francisco on Wednesday night, because ain't no way I'm making that flight on Tuesday, because our Filipino brothers and sisters in the audience know there is no way you can get from Tuguegarao City in the northern part of Cagayan all the way down to Manila in 2 hours. That is about the distance from Sacramento to Los Angeles. But in the Philippines, it takes at least 2 times as long as it does here, because the roads are not paved like our roads. They're much narrower. They're usually only one lane going each direction. And the top speed is usually around 45 miles an hour. That's just the way it is over there. That's just the way it is. So, I get to the airport Wednesday morning. I'm trying to rebook our flight. And I find out that Didit doesn't have clearance from a certain government agency that she needs to leave the Philippines. Now, I had thought that we had not discussed this. We had discussed this. I mistook it for something else. There was a breakdown in communications. It was mostly my fault. I'll cop to it. And there was no way we could get that done on Wednesday. So we're like, okay, let's reschedule our flight for Friday. We're going to miss Thanksgiving. It's the way it's going to happen. Sorry, Grandma. That's the way it's got to be. So I wrote to the elders what was my time Thursday night, local time Thursday morning. So they had all the information as of Thursday morning. They know I wrote to you guys and told you what was going on. And so Thursday morning, Didith goes to this government agency to get this clearance that she needs. And that doesn't cost very much. It's like less than $10. It's not a big deal. And it's the Commission for Filipinos Overseas, or the CFO. And they require fiancés and spouses of foreigners to have clearance from the CFO before they leave the country. That's the way it is. And they're supposed to attend a special counseling seminar before they get this clearance. And this counseling seminar was basically everything that every single woman tells their daughter before they ought to get married, before they're getting married in the first place. What married life is like. What living with a husband is going to be like. What it's like when you have kids. Make sure you have time for your husband when you have kids. Make sure you have time for yourself when you have kids. Stuff like that. There are other things that happen, but we had to deal with that. And then after this ordeal with the CFO was over, we find out that Aria, even though she's a U.S. citizen, she's not a Filipino citizen, Aria needs special clearance to leave the country. I know. And that cost nearly $200. And that was at the Bureau of Immigration in the part of our Filipinos, Intramuros. The BOI there, that means within the walls. It's the old Spanish city, Intramuros is. So we go there. And we go there first thing in the morning because we were told at the CFO that you can just go there, it takes less than a day, and you're going to be done. It's going to be fine. It's going to be painless. So we go there. And we get there. And we hear that it takes 3 business days. I was ready for violence. I did not actually hurt anybody. Not even a wall. And so we ask the guy at the front desk, is there any way that we could get this expedited? I mean, do you guys have an option for that kind of thing? Even if we have to pay extra fees, we're willing to pay that. Can we get that done? And so what he says is, well, give me your claim stub and then come back later today. No, thank you. Because it's going to take some of this to get the claim stub back and not in an official capacity. So we asked the person at the window, is there any way we could try and get this expedited? Because we have a flight booked later today. This is Friday morning. And so they tell us, come back between 3 and 4 this afternoon. We'll try, but we have no guarantees whatsoever. She was honest. Like, we'll try. I can't promise you anything. Just try and come back. So there we are. And we go and we have lunch with some of Didit's family that lives in Manila. It was actually really great. And when we found out we were taking a bus to Manila and we're going to try and rebook our flight, we actually took my in-laws. We took Didit's parents with us on the bus. We got them a hotel room, the same hotel we were staying at. And it turned out that That was awesome because we really needed their help. Because here we are dodging, you know, one part of the city to another part of the city, trying to go to different government agencies to get stuff taken care of. And dealing with Aria was kind of hard amidst all that. I'm sure you could probably imagine. Try and deal with a toddler at the DMV. Not fun. No. The DMV alone is not fun. Adding a fussy toddler on top of that makes you want to kill yourself. Not literally. You guys get what I mean. And so it turned out to be a real blessing to have them there. And it was also a real blessing because that meant Didith got a few extra special days with her parents, where her parents didn't have to compete with her sisters and our nieces and our nephew for Didith and Aria's attention. And I know they really enjoyed having that. So there were a few blessings in disguise there in all of that. So it was good to have them there. It was good to have them there for that. And I really appreciated that. So we finally get to the back to the Bureau of Immigration. And we leave where we were having lunch with her family at. We're trying to get there. We're in a taxi. We're not sure if we're going to even get there before it closes. We're really worried what's going to happen. We get there around 3:30. We go up, and I wait in line at the window. And Aria starts getting fussy and starts having a meltdown. And so Didith has to take her aside and have to sit in some of the waiting chairs that are there. And there we are. And I'm standing at the window. And I go there, and I give my claim stuff. And the gentleman at the window pulls it out, pulls out the paperwork. He says, "Is that you?" I'm like, "Yeah, that's me." And he says, "Here you go." And I said, I said to him in Tagalog, it's okay for us to leave tonight? And he says, "Yeah, it's great." I could finally breathe easy. And then we went back to the hotel. And if you've ever been in Manila around 4 or 5 in the afternoon, and if you've ever been in Intramuros, you know that it's almost impossible to get a taxi in Intramuros to go anywhere at that hour of the day. So now we're waiting to try and get a taxi in Intramuros back to Pasay, which is kind of close, not really. It's another part of Manila. That's the part of Manila where our hotel was at. That's the part of Manila that's right next to Parañaque, which is where the airport is. So there we are, trying to deal with this, and not sure if we're going to get back to the hotel in time for us to check out. We managed to get back to the hotel 30 minutes before we're supposed to check out. Okay, I'm breathing a little easier. But Aria hasn't had a bath in a couple days, and she really needs one before we get on the plane. Let me tell you. So Didith is in there with her mom, rushing Aria to get clean, for which we are all grateful. And so finally, Aria's clean, bags are packed, getting in the hotel. We got a car from the hotel to go to the airport. And we get to the airport, and I find out there while we're getting care of taking our tickets issued that we have to get either a refund or something that happened with our tickets from Tuguegarao to Manila, because if the flights are out of sequence, they won't let us board. So there I have to wait at this ticket service counter, and I'm waiting like 30, 35 minutes because the people in front of me didn't go to the PAL ticketing office. They actually went inside the terminal to the ticket service counter to buy brand new tickets for a flight to Hong Kong that night. They didn't book it online. They didn't go to the ticket counter at another part of the airport. No, they had to march in the terminal in front of people who had other business to take care of at that desk. And there was only one person working that desk. So here we are, worried about whether or not we're actually going to get on the plane. And then once I finally got up there, we had to wait about another 15, 20 minutes. And so we finally got that, and we finally got a resolve that I have to get a refund here. Not there, but they let us board the plane. And I'm actually kind of glad Aria was cranky and didn't get her nap on Friday, because that means she slept on the plane. But I am so glad to be home. Once we got to the airport in San Francisco, it's funny, I've told people about the first time we applied for her visa and all the nightmarish red tape that we had to deal with from the Department of State. This time it was the other government. Because we got to the airport in San Francisco. We went through that initial customs check where there's that desk, and everybody stamps your passport before you go to baggage claim. And Dennis was a first-time immigrant, and so we went through that. And then we went to this secondary check where it's the Bureau of Customs and Border Protection, the CPB or the CBP guys. And they're really hardcore. Understandably so. I totally support that hardcoreness with what their job entails. And so we get into this room where they're checking everybody's visas. And there's a line of like 10, 12 folders before ours. But we put our bags down and they say, we will protect your bags, don't worry. That never happens in an airport, because here I am. What I'm doing is, Didith is carrying one backpack. Now, we actually booked a seat for Aria. So she had two checked bags of her own, each that could be 50 pounds. She had two carry-ons. We maximized the potential here. So here I am, backpack, duffel bag strapped on the other shoulder, duffel bag in each hand. And I am the pack mule walking through the airport at this point. And so I'm so glad they were willing to watch our bags. So they say, watch your bags. You can sit out there where it's nice and it's cooler and there's nobody there. And your little girl can walk around and she can play. We will protect your bags for you. Oh, thank you, Lord. And so we got there and just said, sit down. We'll be done in about 2 or 3 minutes. Took a little longer than 2 or 3 minutes, but it was less than 10. They fast-tracked us. Less than 10 minutes later, they brought out all three of our passports. They showed us Didis' passport, and they said, this stamp for the next 2 weeks is her green card. We skipped the entire provisional status requirement of visas because I was a permanent resident of the Philippines, and I'd been living there for over 2 years. Didis could theoretically leave the country today if she wanted to and then come back. So, I called VR when we were on 101 driving home from the airport Friday night. And he could tell I was just tired, but so relieved. So as we were singing that song, Count Your Blessings, you guys have a little inkling of what was going through my mind now. But I am just so happy to be here. Now, getting into our sermon, Psalm 90. There's my little summary of my events. I hope you don't mind that I took the time to do that, because everybody's been asking me, and you guys know by now, I'll tell the story once here, and then that's okay. So, Psalm 90. This was actually a text that I was asked to prepare a sermon for while I was in the Philippines by my wife's uncle, whom Daisy knows, Felipe Catolos. They've known each other for a long time. Back in the days when both were attending churches with instrumental music in the Philippines. And so, this is a psalm that's actually, I find, quite beautiful. I never prepared a sermon about this psalm and what it really means and what it really entails and what the purpose of this song is. And so, Felipe, the first Sunday I was there, he said, next week, I want you to prepare a sermon. He said, at the end of worship service in front of everybody. He said, will you please prepare an expository sermon about Psalm 90? And I said, Psalm 90? And he said, yes, Psalm 90. And I said, okay, because I had no choice. But it turned out to be really great because I love this psalm. And it's a message that I think is very profound, and it's something that I think all of God's people really need to understand. And so if I go over 12, please don't pull the trap door. I had a little bit of an explanation to give before. I'll try to be as brief as possible, but I need to give this psalm its justice. My actual sermon will be no longer than any other sermon. I promise you that. Psalm 90 was written by Moses. And it was written at some point during the wilderness wanderings. Some point while they were out in the middle of the desert because the children of Israel had disobeyed God. And it was written during this time period. And so we know Moses was older than 80, younger than 120. But by that point, he was quite possibly the oldest man in the entire camp, If not, he was certainly among them. It depends on how old the 72 elders were and how many of them had died by this point. But at the very least, he was among one of the oldest members of the camp. He was a man who had lived for 40 years among power and privilege and prestige in Egypt. As my friend Ann Sanderson called it, he had lived surrounded by the pretty, the pleasurable, and the prestigious. And then he had lived 40 years in exile in the deserts of Midian, watching over a bunch of dumb animals that would get themselves killed if you didn't drive yourself crazy trying to protect them. Sheep are stupid. And so, here's Moses. And now he's in charge of a nation. And he's leaving. And he's seen a lot of things. And he writes, and he tries to tell the children of Israel about the things that are really important in life. That's really what this psalm is about. This psalm is about life. And it may not appear that way, because Moses doesn't start out talking about life. He starts off talking about God. And I want to make a few comments here about the age of Moses and what he was like. In Deuteronomy chapter 34, verse 7, one of the things that we are told that in order for Moses to perform the task that God had given him, God had granted to him a few very special blessings. When he died at 120 years old, his eyesight remained undimmed and his vigor, as the King James says, had not abated. That means he still walked upright. He was still strong. He had his staff, not because he needed it, but because it had become a symbol of his office. He didn't need his staff. He could walk probably better than me. I have extra pounds. My back starts to hurt. I know. I need to drop them. They are what they are. I'll do what I can. But Moses is in this position where he's over 80. He still walks like a young man. He sees clearly. He hears clearly. He still possesses all of his mental faculties. But he sees everyone around him, his friends, his family, dying. I wonder, out of curiosity, if he didn't write this maybe just after Aaron and Miriam had died. Maybe, I don't know. We don't know when he wrote it. But we do know that because Moses wrote this, this is one of the three oldest surviving pieces of poetry in the entire world. Psalm 90 is one of the three oldest surviving, I say surviving, because I'm sure there are poems that are older than this, we just don't have records of them. The other ones are Exodus chapter 15 and Deuteronomy chapter 32. All three of them by Moses. And they are quite beautiful and exquisite examples of Hebrew poetry. I want to start off by reading the first six verses. Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all the ages. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. You return man to dust and say, return, O children of men. For 1,000 years in your sight are but as yesterday when it is past, or as a watch in the night. You sweep them away with a flood. They are like a dream, like grass that is renewed in the morning. And in the morning it flourishes and is renewed. In the evening it fades and withers. This song about life starts off with contemplating the eternity of God. Because if we think about our lives as human beings, the things that help us define and mark our lives and give them shape and purpose, the very mechanism that we use to consider ourselves and our existence introspectively, has absolutely no meaning with God. We are creatures of time. We define our lives by time. One of the most important things with which we identify ourselves, when we meet people for the first time, when we talk about ourselves, when we start getting to know each other, one of the questions that, well, at least men will very often ask themselves is, how old are you? Because that helps us relate to other people. Because once we have an idea of how old someone is, or when we speak to a lady, we very politely ask them other questions to try and get a sense, because in this society it's not polite to ask a woman how old she is. We try and make an educated guess. Because understanding someone's age helps us relate to them as a person, because it gives us an understanding of what they have seen in their lives and of where they are and of the things that they have experienced. So it helps us form a common bond with them so we can build bridges and communicate with one another. Time is how we relate to each other as human beings. But time is the very thing that separates us from God. One of the very things. We think about time, we think about God existing before the mountains were brought forth, before He had formed the earth and the world. Moses says, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. One of the very first sermons I did after I got here, a couple months after I got here, I started talking about what God is like, what His characteristics are. We talked about His omnipotence, and I used the scope of the universe to relate just exactly how powerful God is, how old God is, how ancient God is. Because science, whatever your perspective is, science tells us that the Earth itself is 4.6 or 4.7, depending on which geological timeline you use, 4.7 billion years old. How do we relate to that number? We can't. We have to throw out meaningless words like billion. How do you relate to a billion? The very concept, when I talked about how far things were away from the Earth, I talked about the distance from the Earth to the Moon, I talked about the distance from the Earth to the Sun, the distance from our Sun to its nearest star, I talked about the distance from our solar system to the center of our galaxy, how far across that was in light years, then I talked about the nearest galaxy to our own, and the farthest one away from us, which is 7.8 billion light years away, and it was 7.8 billion light years away, 7.8 billion years ago. Do the math on that. Double that. That's how far away it is now. How do we cannot comprehend. I said, trying to comprehend these numbers, it will melt your brain. We throw out words like astronomical because, duh, it has to do with astronomy. In a very literal sense, those numbers are entirely and purely astronomical. I studied this stuff. I have trouble understanding, with coming to grips with exactly how large the universe is, how old, how ancient it either is or appears to be. Make your choice. I don't care. But before all that, God says, I am. The eternity of God is actually the foundation for the rest of the psalm, and it's the foundation for our understanding of life itself. Because the next thing Moses talks about says, we are brought to an end by your anger, and by your wrath we are dismayed. You have set our iniquities before you and our secret sins in the light of your presence. For all our days pass away under your wrath, and we bring our years to an end like a sigh. Because the important thing about life is that it's death that gives it meaning. Death is what gives life its purpose. Moses saw death probably more than any other man in the history of the world. I wonder what it was like for him leading Israel, waking up every morning and hearing the death toll of the people who had died the days before. Because when the children of Israel disobeyed God that one time and they refused to enter Canaan, even though Joshua and Caleb bravely stood up and said, no, it doesn't matter what they're like, it doesn't matter how many of them there are, it doesn't matter how strongly fortified their cities are, because God is on our side, who can stand against us? The people didn't listen, they disobeyed, and they said, no, we're too afraid, we can't do it. And God cursed them to wander in the wilderness for 40 years. And everyone except for Joshua and Caleb and Moses, who was over the age of 20, died in the wilderness. Think about that. Think about Moses waking up every morning, and there's that announcement of the people who had died in the night. 72 men who were leaders of Israel were replaced during his lifetime. Some of those positions probably multiple times, because you don't appoint a young man as an elder. How many elders did Israel go through during those 40 years? How many men did Moses work with, trying to guide, trying to shape, trying to mold the people of Israel into a people who were holy and just and righteous? And how many of them died before the task could be completed? How many men did Moses stand by their graveside? How many men did he do that with? And it wasn't just them. I mean, these verses are not talking about death in general. They're talking about death because of judgment. What about Pharaoh? Moses saw death in Egypt. The 10th plague. Think about what it must have been like for Moses to stand up on the opposite shore of the Sea of Reeds and to lower his staff and to watch those waves of water come crashing down and bury the armies of Egypt. Yes, they were Egyptians. Yes, they had enslaved his people. But yes, from a certain extent, he was also kind of one of them. He had been raised among these people. He shared some of their cultural identity. And now he sees the empire come crashing down. And I imagine a little part of him was sad, because that was the home of his youth. Imagine the deaths of his countrymen that he commissioned his fellow tribesmen to bring about during the episode of the golden calf. When he asked that question, who is on the side of Yahweh? And his tribesmen, the tribe of Levi, stood up and they answered the call and they said, what must we do? He said, strap your sword on your thigh, get your shield and get your spear, and you go throughout the encampment and you kill everyone you see doing this until nobody's doing it anymore. The deaths he ordered. Think about the destruction of Korah and his supporters, the earth opening up as a fissure right underneath their feet and then closing again. Think about what Moses saw there. Korah was ambitious. He was jealous. But I can't help but think that he was ambitious and jealous because he was probably pretty smart. Because the people who think they can do a better job, more often than not, have at least a little bit of reason for their confidence. And I imagine that Moses saw not only the destruction of a man who was rebelling against God, but the sad loss of what Korah could have been. And I imagine a part of him wept for that. Imagine the death that he saw during the plague of the poisonous serpents, because the people whined and complained and groaned and moaned. What happened at Peor, when they were crossing to go into Jordan, finally, again, at the end of this 40 years of wilderness wanderings, when he had finally thought he had taught the people along with Aaron and his sons and his grandsons to actually try and do what's right. Now Aaron is dead, his son Eleazar is high priest, and the people again engage in idolatry and sexual immorality, and by this time Moses is despondent and he's pretty much given up because he's sitting there at the entrance to the tabernacle moaning and weeping and crying and tearing his clothes and doing nothing. Because he's sick of it. And it's his grandnephew Phinehas that has to step up and put a stop to it. He saw his friends and family die one by one as a result of disobedience. But even if our death doesn't come from judgment, there is still judgment after we die. Moses continues and he writes, the years of our lives are 70, or even by reason of strength, 80. Yet their span, another way of translating this Hebrew word, their pride is but toil and trouble. They are soon gone and we fly away. For who considers the power of your anger and your wrath according to the fear of you? Some people die because they're judged. The rest of us are judged when we die. Life itself, though, even if we don't come to our end because of the reasons of Korah or Pharaoh or of those who are engaging in the worship of the golden calf or of those who are worshiping Baal at Peor because of the enticement of Balak and Balaam, death still comes to us all. Because that very thing which defines our existence as human beings, time, affects all of us. I once heard a friend of mine who was a preacher. Some of you know him, Eddie Brulette. He has passed on, he has gone to his reward. Very wonderful man, very great man, very awesome sense of humor. He said to me, "Boy, I'm 84 years old. When I hit 70... I hit my expected time. So I said, Lord, every time you give me from here on out to 80 is bonus time. Now that I'm older than 80, boy, I'm living on borrowed time." That was Eddie Brulette. The average lifespan of a human being naturally is about 70 years. And in Moses' day, it was much the same as it is now. Barring injury, infection, sickness, 70 is about the normal. Yet sometimes if a person takes very good care of themselves, if they take exceptionally good care of themselves, or if we have an amazing medical care system, we can pass 70 and start creeping toward 80. The English Standard Version translates, their span is toil and trouble. The years of our life are 70. This is verse 10. Or even by reason of strength, 80. Yet their span is toil and trouble. I like the way some of the older versions translate it. Better. The King James, I know I bag on the King James a lot. This is an instance in which I think it's awesome. Yet their pride is but toil and trouble. I want to read a passage from the book of Ecclesiastes. And then we'll come back to Psalm 90. Ecclesiastes chapter 12. Beginning in verse 1. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near, of which you will say, I have no pleasure of them, or no pleasure in them. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened and the clouds return after the rain. In the day in which the keepers of the house tremble. And the strong men are bent, and the grinders cease teeth, because they are few. And those who look through the windows are dimmed, and the doors on the street are shut. When the sound of the grinding is low, when one rises up at the sound of the bird, and the daughters of song are brought low.
when they are afraid of what is on high and our terrors are in the way, when the almond tree whose leaves are gray and white blossoms, and desire, or the grasshopper drags itself along, when desire fails, because man is going to his eternal home, and mourners go about the streets, before the silver cord is snapped, the golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher is shattered at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern, and the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. I like the way the ESV translates verse 10 of Psalm 90 for this very reason. Because as we get older, all these things that Solomon speaks of in Ecclesiastes using poetic imagery start to happen. The keepers of the house tremble. Strong men are bent. The grinders cease. Our bodies, as we age, begin to fall apart. And as we creep from 70 to 80, that becomes all too commonplace. One of those things that I heard Eddie Brulette say to me when I was in Indio just starting my training, and he had just moved there after he retired, I don't know, for the umpteenth time, he said to me, "Aaron, I can't wait for the Lord to call me home." Because as we age, as that strength turns to sadness, as existence itself becomes miserable, God's people know what awaits them. And I have heard so many of our older brothers and sisters who have lived for so long and served the Lord so well, I have heard them, all of them, say, not in these exact words, I'm being blunt to make a point, but they, all of them, have said to me at some point or another with whom this subject has come up in our discussions, they say to me, "Aaron, I cannot wait to die." Because life itself becomes a burden. And what awaits after judgment for the righteous is greater. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. All is vanity. Cancer. Heart disease. Dementia. Alzheimer's. Bill Brown, who worked with me, suffered kidney and liver failure. Death is what makes the final lesson so important. I'm going to finish reading the psalm, and I'm going to go to one verse, make a couple comments, and then I'll be done. So, teach us to number our days, that we may get a heart of wisdom. Return, O Lord. How long? Have pity on your servants. Satisfy us in the morning with your steadfast love, that we may rejoice and be glad all our days. Make us glad for as many days as you have afflicted us, and for as many years as we have seen evil. Let your work be shown to your servants, and your glorious power to their children. So let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us, and establish the work of our hands. Yes, establish the work of our hands forever. Death is what gives our life meaning and purpose. Human beings, we've always sought one thing. We've always sought, each of, and every culture throughout time has sought for immortality. The Greeks, the golden apple, ambrosia. Spaniards sought for the fountain of youth in the new world. I'm reminded of the tale of Achilles before he left for the Trojan War. His mother told him that if, before he was leaving, as he was contemplating leaving Greece to go to war against Troy, his mother told him, this is the legend of the Greek mythology, if you stay, you will die happy and old, your children will love you, your grandchildren will remember you, and their children after them, but then your name will disappear. If you go to war with Troy, you will never come back. But your name will live forever. And today, we call a part of the body the Achilles tendon. We all seek immortality. We all seek to live forever. We understand the fact, though, that that's never going to happen. The Greeks figured this out. And they figured out the fact that the only way we can achieve immortality is if our deeds live on in the memory and words of others. Most of us will never achieve this here on earth. Very few men have done this. Winston Churchill, George Washington. Some have done it for evil. Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, Pol Pot, Mao Zedong. But the great thing that those of us who know the Word of God understand is that all of us achieve immortality in this very fashion. I want to read from the book of Revelation, chapter 20. Promise I'm almost done. Promise. Revelation chapter 20, beginning in verse 11. Then I saw a great white throne, and him who was seated on it. From his presence, earth and sky fled away, and no place was found in them. And I saw the dead, great and small, standing before the throne, and books were opened. And another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged by what was written in the books, according to what they had done. And the sea gave up the dead who were in it. Death and Hades gave up the dead who were in them. And they were judged, each one of them, according to what they had done. And then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. And this is the second death, the lake of fire. And if anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. Each and every one of us has achieved immortality, not in the memory of men, but in the memory of God. Because each and every one of us have our deeds recorded for all time. And that if we have not embraced Christ, if we have not dedicated our life to service, if we have not entered into that covenant through which we are sanctified by the blood of Christ, then our sins will remain on our record for all time. And only through Christ can they be wiped away. Solomon writes at the end of the book of Ecclesiastes, in chapter 12, verses 13 and 14, he says, "This is the matter. All things have been heard. Fear God and keep His commandments. For this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring everything into judgment, whether good or evil, along with every secret thing." Those are the things that are written in the books that are talked about in the Revelation. If you have not entered into that covenant through the blood of Christ so that you can have those things wiped away from your record, we'd encourage you to do so. Because we have to live so that we can be ready to die. And if you'd like to make the first step on that journey, please come forward and let us know as we stand and sing song number 263.